Hello and welcome to the latest Blood Red podcast from the Liverpool Echo. I'm Joe Rimmer and we're not on video today, unfortunately, but I am with Ian Doyle. How are we, Ian?
I am very audio today.
Just audio today.
A little token there of opening a Fanta Lemon.
And Theo Squires, how are you?
I'm very good. This is the best I've ever looked on a Blood Red podcast.
Yeah, it certainly is. The reason we're only doing audio today is our producer, Ian, for due to unforeseen circumstances, shall we say, is not able to come to the office today and record us. So emergency sort of audio-only pod, but the show must go on, as they say, and the show is going on. I've got my can of Carabao. We're still...
He genuinely does have a can of Carabao, by the way.
Yeah, another mixed berry, yeah.
Did we get four? That's the one that's left over.
I've got some at home, and then I had one yesterday as well.
You've not sent any freebies yet?
No, still trying. No, I'll keep going. At least till the end of the season, no cliches, just Carabao. I'm still hoping for the merch as well. There's one person on the YouTube comments.
Surely no cliches, just Carabao is in danger of becoming a cliche itself.
Never.
Or is it a slogan?
It's a slogan. It's a blood red slogan.
Slogan become a cliche?
I don't know. That's not where we were going to start. We were going to start in Nottingham. And,
you have to.
Both of you were in Nottingham. Yeah, I'm sure you don't want to go straight back on. But let's start, actually, because it's been doing my head in, really, the last couple of days. Obviously, great win for Liverpool, much, much needed. They battled. It was a bit of a slog, and they got a very late win through Darwin Nunes. But all the talk ever since, and with it not being on TV, and I wasn't there, I was in the office sort of producing, sat down that night to watch Match of the Day, thought, I'll enjoy this. And all they talked about was... a certain refereeing decision from Paul Tierney at the end in favour of Liverpool.
This is dropped so much the day. It was amusing that they kept showing the Elanga chances. Oh, they should have taken that. And they didn't mention once it was offside.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but the whole conversation since, I listened to TalkSport on my way in this morning. They talked about it there. They talked about it on Sky. Mike Dean had a little segment just before the Manchester derby yesterday, calling it a huge error. Are you both surprised, having been there, watched the match, saw the result? Ian, we'll start with you. That is all the conversation. Did it register at the time?
This is the drop ball. To me, wasn't it, after the goal went in?
Yeah.
They were absolutely livid about it, not in Forest, the players and everything. Now, this has had to be done in the context of a rule that literally I did not know anything about until after this game when I had to do a bit of reading up about it.
Yeah.
Is that... if there's a head injury from a player inside the... I think it's inside the penalty area, and the ball is still inside the penalty area. No matter who has it, the ball has to be dropped at the feet of the goalkeeper. Now, apparently, the rule... they have to get restarted. Whoever is in possession. Now, for... that is what counted with... Harvey Elliott had a shot at the start of the second half where he had a shot, and it hit Ryan Yates, the Nottingham Forest captain, in the head. He fell over. I think it was Origi ended up heading it out of the area and it fell towards two Liverpool players who were waiting. But before Origi managed to get his head onto it, the referee blew.
Yeah.
Which meant that the game then got restarted with the ball at the feet of the Nottingham Forest goalkeeper, to which I was like, that's a bit odd because I didn't understand what the rule was. I didn't know there was a rule. Then the one at the end is obviously Canati goes down with a head injury.
Yeah.
The ball goes outside the area. I think it was Hudson-Odoi, I think, was that had it. Referee blows up and the rule is that he should have actually dropped it at the feet of the Nottingham Forest player. Now, we're talking like half a second from difference between where the ball was. So maybe the referee just thought, I'm just going to level this up and drop the ball over there because I did that earlier in the second half with the Liverpool chance, but technically he shouldn't have done that. Now, so that's that, and that's what the argument is about. And apparently it was a terrible mistake by Tierney, who obviously is renowned for making one or two boops, as I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. He
hopefully we're still going to be on air in the Middle East.
Can we say that? Yeah, we did. And you know, he's made quite a lot of mistakes, like most referees have. And apparently, this is one of the worst ones he's ever made. Now, bear in mind that in that the mistake he actually made initially was not to give a free kick for Liverpool because it was put up by Yates, who went in at the near post, quite dangerous with his foot up.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't necessarily think it was him that connected with Canati to go down. I think it was Callagher that he banged into. But his foot was right there.
Yeah.
So anywhere else on the pitch, it's a free kick. And if he'd hit his foot and gone in, it would have been disallowed for foot up.
Yeah.
And so that's that.
Foot up, high foot, foot up.
Let's say both.
Yeah. You not clocked the match of the day, pointed this out. They were doing a VAR check on whether Forest should have had a penalty.
Well, there was sort of goals, wasn't it? Yes, but then Liverpool, yeah. Then you could argue, this is the whole point, then you're down that rabbit hole, and Liverpool should have had a penalty with doubts, which I don't think that was a penalty, and I don't think the Forest one was a penalty either. Now, that's all well and good, and it was a mistake. But nearly 2 minutes passed between Forest having the ball, Liverpool getting the ball there, and Forest conceding the goal. Now, there's a couple of things here. People say, well, the passage of play completely changed. It did, you're right. Forest had done nothing with high balls into the box all the way through that game. They'd done nothing. Their chances had come from counters or low crosses when they had countered. That's where their best chances came from, and their only chances, actually. So, taking a cross that into the box, that's assuming that Hudson-Odoi gets past the two Liverpool players who've gone on to him. Liverpool then break, and then they can counter. Now, Liverpool, by the time of the goal, the free kick's taken, everybody's got back into position, so Liverpool have to get past every single Nottingham Forest player again. Mm-hmm. And in that passage of play, Forest actually have possession twice. Once where they over-hit a pass, don't they, up to the wing, and it goes out for a throw-in. Second one is where they get the ball from that final corner and could clear it and decide to dribble it, or pass it and then dribble it, lose the ball, and then it's a goal. So, while it's a mistake, I don't quite understand what context that has. Genuinely, what context that has with the goal that Liverpool scored, because that's Forest's fault. They should have cleared it. They shouldn't have allowed Liverpool to get that far upfield. They shouldn't have conceded the corners quite needlessly the way, good play by Gomez, but they could easily have not conceded that corner. And I do think there's a little that people weren't looking at the Elliot. I mean, why would you look at the Elliot thing if you weren't there?
Yeah.
It's just the thing. Why would you look? But it's just a nice little comparison. Klopp and some of the Liverpool players spotted it, and like me, they weren't fully up to speed with the actual ruling, but it just seems an odd ruling in itself. And I don't think anybody would have complained, anyone, if the first one or the second one, the ball gets dropped at the feet of the Liverpool player and the Forest player. Yeah. Nobody would have been, because everyone just thought, well, that's clearly what should happen.
Yeah.
Maybe the referee just thought he was evening it up, because apparently he said, didn't he, to Yates after the, well, during the game, he said, I did exactly the same thing up there, of just applying the rule. That's the rule, is what he said. Yeah. He said, that's the rule, but it turns out that it wasn't.
Yeah.
That long enough answer.
That is a very long... I mean, it's interesting, though, isn't it? Because I didn't really necessarily want to start today's pod with a big talk about referees, but I think there's something, Theo, this season, we've really seen a lot of things have been bubbling under the surface. There's, if you, in terms of context, in terms of, like, finances, financial fair play, Man City, Newcastle, then this VAR, you know, the last couple of years has sort of been building up to it. And, you know, you don't want to be a hypocrite because, like, we are the media. So it's a big thing for us. You know, you talk about decisions. It does drive, I'm sure there'll be more listeners because you talk about these types of decisions. We certainly get more clicks, more readers when we talk about controversy, that sort of thing. But I feel like this season's been building up, and we saw massively the other hypocrisy is that Liverpool obviously talked long and loud about a decision earlier this season at Tottenham. But I feel like it's been built up, and this season we've gone completely berserk with almost every game. There has to be like a theme of referees making mistakes. All the referees are really poor, and I've argued on this podcast quite a lot that I don't think referees are that poor. I don't think referees have ever been any... Not to say that they've never been any good, because I think it's an impossible job. And if you know what I mean, they've always been the same level, which is never, no one will ever be satisfied. They could sack all the referees at the end of the season, bring in a whole new referees, and everyone would say the same thing midway through next season. They'd say the standard refereeing is really bad in this country. And if you go to any other country, look what's just happened at Real Madrid, they'll tell you the same thing. Yeah. The standard of refereeing is bad, and that, you know, there's, you know, they need to change this, that, and the other. But I think this season we've had this thing where, like, in the amount of times you go on social media and see people talking about corruption about their teams, Man City fans talking about corruption against their team. I mean, that's crazy. It works both ways.
It's because somebody said it initially, whoever it was. Some team said, oh, it's corruption, and then everyone's just jumped onto it.
It feels like this season it really...
Surely if every team is corrupt against, then it evens
itself out. It evens itself out
of the season. Yeah.
But I can't even remember what I was trying to ask you, Theo. I'm just going to be soapbox a little bit there, but it... It feels like every game needs a theme around it. And this one, they picked out a decision at the end, which I thought was pretty... I think Beth Lindop said it well in the office before, where she said, if they'd given a throw in the other way, we wouldn't have a big discussion. But because it was a specific rule and moment, it feels like that has become the talking point of the game, and Forest have whipped that up themselves by having Mark Clattenburg as an advisor. How did you see it all, and how ridiculous is it that they have Mark Clattenburg complaining on their behalf?
I think that's the issue in itself, isn't it? Like, that was the story. Was it last week or the week before that they'd appointed Clattenburg in this role? And that was a bit strange in itself. But then first chance he gets, he's come out front of the media and he's made it more of a thing. Like, no one else is a referee cheerleader behind them going, this is how wrong this is.
I'm sure his old colleagues must be absolutely delighted that he's doing
yeah,
that.
Yeah, very much so. Like, you think after the Tottenham mistake, they want to defend the officials when they go, it's human error, but yeah, they'll go too hard on it. Well, here they seem to have thrown Tierney under the bus a little bit, going, it's a monumental error. Every single former official seems to be coming out and just...
That's what Mike Dean said, isn't he? Monumental error.
Yeah,
monumental error.
And he was one of the ones who seemed quite defensive. Yeah. By the ones earlier in the season, was it Mike Dean as well, who admitted that he didn't want to give a penalty on VAR or something?
Yeah, because he didn't want to send his mate to the monitor in a difficult game, was it?
Yeah, so there's no consistency there at all.
But there never will be consistency, but I don't want to go back on the box.
The irony is, this was the referee trying to apply some consistency. It was just not applied correctly. But there's 2 minutes between these two decisions. It's only a massive talking point because Forrest had kicked up such a fuss because the chairman's come down to the pitch because Clattenburg's come and said something afterwards, having been appointed in that role in the first place. Like, can you imagine if Liverpool had appointed someone in that role before the Tottenham game and they came out fighting for them after that decision? And this brings it back to the Spurs goal. It was a wrong decision. The officials knew it was a wrong decision and they still couldn't do anything about it. Whereas this, they thought they were doing the right thing. It just turns out it wasn't.
Yeah. I think the fact that Jermaine Jean is supposed to Nottingham Forest might have something to do with
the match of the day as well. Yeah. Yeah.
Going back to that Clattenburg thing, I don't actually have a problem with him being a kind of, if he's an advisory former official, that's good in a way because that helps Forest understand what this, that and the other is. And the players know, and so they know what the rules are because the rules always change. So nothing wrong with that. But it was a bit weird that he ended up in the mix-up. For anybody who's not, who doesn't know, that's where the players and the journalists mingle after the game. Or rather, the players completely ignore the journalists. but Clattenburg was brought out specifically to talk about it. It's like, okay, I understand that he'd probably know more about it than anyone else, but that's not what his job supposedly is meant to be, is it? I mean, I don't know what his job is at Nottingham Forest exactly, what his role is, but it seems odd that he should be doing that. But yeah, I just think, come on. If we're talking about injustices, Liverpool about the ultimate one, and I think this season anyway, and I think that you asked why were they throwing people under the bus and monumental error, and is it that there are some people there who are anti-Liverpool? I don't know.
Corruption.
Corruption. And we're talking about the people who set the narrative in the sense that we will always be sympathetic as the Liverpool Echo towards Liverpool and Everton, and the Manchester News will be sympathetic towards Manchester United and Manchester City and so on.
Yeah.
You do wonder whether or not. But this is just actually, I'm just going to talk generally about journalism, yeah, is that my worry is that people, not just involved in this story, is that it's become a little bit too tribalistic, where you used to never know which journalists supported. And I just think that we're kind of stepping a little bit away from that, and I preferred it when no one knew.
Social media is
just be straight down the middle.
Yeah. And then you wore an Arsenal coat and everyone found out you support Arsenal.
Well, there is that.
To be fair, I mean, this has kind of moved. I think it's an interesting discussion, moving slightly away from, well, a lot away from the Forest game. I remember when I started and I was operating both of our daily live blogs, Neil Jones sort of trying to help me in not showing my allegiances. And then as pods came in and social media came in, we kind of moved away from that because, I mean, ultimately, it's very difficult to not show your allegiances.
We're supposed to have an allegiance to the club that we cover.
Yeah, yeah.
That's fine. Yeah. I'm on about not naming any names at all, but just the whole general, what's supposed to be the national media, the kind of, whether it's the newspapers or it's the radio or it's the television or whoever. My view is that while there are a lot of people there who are still very straight down the middle and very neutral, and that's what you need to be, because then that gives you the kind of scope to comment one way or other on something, and you're opinion then carries a amount of weight, because if someone has been straight down the middle and says this, then it must be something bad or good. If you're a bit of a cheerleader for a certain team, and I don't necessarily mean the former players because that's completely different, then you've got a bit of an issue.
It's very difficult though, isn't it? Because some people will have, even like, so we support Liverpool, but so you obviously you might get wound up by Man United or Everton or teams like that, but then you might also find Like, I'll be honest, Arsenal irritate me a fair bit, so I often find them very irritating.
I wonder whether it's a generational thing, because you look at someone like, I'm going to name a name now, Mark Chapman, who does quite a lot of stuff, and he's very good broadcasting, he's very good, and I really like him.
Yeah.
But he's quite obviously a Man United fan, and he's quite open about it, but that doesn't impact his work whatsoever. Mm. Doesn't impact it, and in some ways it kind of helps it, because some fans see, like, oh, this is clearly a supporter, so I can empathise with some of the things that they're going through. And that's a good thing in a way.
Yeah.
But there are some that just take it too far the other way and it just gets a bit silly. Yeah. And at least, you know, he's open about it, whereas some people are a bit more underhand about it.
See, I think it's better to be open. Dave Prentice, former sports editor, massive blue, never made any secret of it, but wrote some of the best pieces I've ever written about Liverpool Football
You've
Club.
I've ever read.
Taking credit for. Sorry, Nick. Sure, I've ever read. You know, the Barcelona game 4-0. He wrote a piece afterwards. Incredible. You know, some of his. So I think you can say I support X, Y, or Z and still be very, very good at your job, like Mark Chapman, like Dave.
Well, I've just listened back to what I just said in my brain, and it sounds slightly contradictory. But I think the point is that we are pointing these people out as very good exponents of what they do. They're very good anyway, so they're in that position where they've gained the trust that they can say who they support, and no one questions it, that it's going to, in any way, you know, shape their opinions or their job.
Yeah, I think in the social media age, it's very interesting, though, isn't it, Theo, the way themes around matches get whipped up. And I felt this weekend, when the final whistle went, I know there was, you know, there was some anger on the pitch and whatnot, but that's quite often happens, but it feels like it's built and built and built. And when I turned the radio on this morning, they were still talking about it as if Forrest had scored and had the goal ruled out. You know, it was, to me, a very minor thing towards the end of a game that their acting now shaped the entire result.
The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
If I remember right, the entire Forest bench was up fuming just at the ball being given to Kelleher. They weren't. That was before any of this has happened 2 minutes later. And then the fans, they were on the referee all game long. They were on Liverpool all game long. When the goal goes in, obviously we've seen some of the videos on social media of their reaction to that. When Liverpool come down the tunnel after the final whistle, all the Forest fans are chanting, cheats, cheats, cheats. You've seen the chairman on the pitch. You've seen Stephen Reid, who got sent off. There is a lot of fury there from Forest, and you can understand why, like, for them, they're a side that are fighting against relegation. This could be the difference between them staying up or going down, but then so could staying within FFP rules and getting a points deduction or not. So many different things that come into play here, and when there's 2 minutes between it, as Doyle said, they had chances to clear that. They had chances to not concede a corner.
They also had chances to score earlier in the game that they missed, you know, like, so.
I think also they were not happy that it was scored injury time or additional time. But Forrest had two players booked for time wasted in additional time. So I think that's where the extra seconds came from. How long was Sells on the floor when Dan's clattered into him as well? How long was Konate down? And that's before you look at the substitutions. 9 minutes was just, if he adds on eight, and then you get the extra time wasting.
If you're wasting time and you have players punished for wasting time, you then cannot complain that there is time added on.
It's all about the initial
risk you take.
Let's not make any bones about it. It's a good story. It's a good story. It's a good narrative that happened and that happened shortly afterwards. And then immediately after the game, possibly the day after the game, fine, but not today.
Two days ago, nothing else happened. But before we move on from sort of off-pitch stuff, one thing I want to ask you about, Doyle, because you did tweet about it a fair bit and it was written into some of your pieces. Nottingham Forest fans, I mean, quite like Nottingham as an area. I think it's quite a nice place, but... And also Nottingham Castle's very nice. I had a good day there with my son in January. There seems to be several clubs, and I'm going to name them. Nottingham Forest are certainly one. Wolves are certainly one. Leicester are bad for it.
Wolves
are always bad for it.
Leicester's
certainly several clubs that seem to take special glee in the poverty chanting and some of the anti-Liverpool stuff. I mean, I don't know if you've been up to Liverpool lately. If anyone from Nottingham's listening, come and have a look, because if you think it's an S-hole you really need to come and have a look because it's an incredible city, and it's not what many people seem to have had the stereotypes about.
I think with Forest, Liverpool didn't play Forest for years, and they were when I was growing up one of their main rivals, at least for a few years. So I think Forest were quite happy to get Liverpool back at City Ground. It was like that for the FA Cup game. It was certainly like that last season for the league game, and it was like that again on Saturday. I think if anybody wants to know a little bit more about the history, I suggest there's some documentaries, one on Channel 4 in England, BBC, on the miners' strike. Probably worth listening to that. We could do 15 podcasts on that, which might explain a little bit of what's happening there. But the majority of it is to do with football. And I do find, with Leicester and Nottingham, they're both very close to each other in the East Midlands. And this must be something historical. I don't personally know the entirety of it. I've just given two what I think are reasons for it, which I think with Forest that possibly explains it a little bit, but because they were the rivals. They were rivals in the late '70s before I was watching football. That's how long ago it was. They're winning European Cups, knocking Forest, not Liverpool out. The European Cup ended their reign, then took over for 2 years. So they were a big team, and I think the Liverpool have obviously maintained that level. Forest were always punching above the weight. And they're back in the Premier League, and they were a Premier League club when they first started. Liverpool's first game in the Premier League was at Forest. So
I hope they stay. Oh, that's weird.
I do think that some of the stuff that it's just, I don't know whether it's more. I wrote this saying whether they are actually learning from what's happening or whether they just don't want to.
Yeah.
And they were very, very angry for the most part of that game, even before anything controversial happened. They were a very angry bunch, and I don't know what's maybe they've got some issues down there that's got a lot to do with Liverpool, and they're like that for every game, but obviously I only see them when they play Liverpool and they seem to be very angry.
Yeah, certainly. Let's talk about some player performances, Theo. Let's start with the something Andy Carroll, Darwin Nunez, who won the game for Liverpool. I mean, he wasn't out for very long at all, but they did miss him, and it felt like having him to bring off the bench in that game, it just was exactly what they needed. And I think that goal, more than any other, underlines his importance to Liverpool this season and the extra responsibility I think he's taken up. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, he's really stepped up this season. That's, 14 goals now. He's got double figures on assists as well. He's missed a couple of games, and all the fans are just waiting for him to get back, because, when Darwin Nunez is in your squad, never mind your starting 11, you've got a chance.
Yeah.
That's what we saw on Saturday. But it was one of those games where it felt like it was going to be one of those days where Liverpool don't take the chances. They don't really create too much. Every shot on goal was blocked. Every corner, every free kick is headed away. But then he comes on and suddenly they create this little bit more. Like, he has the shot that goes into the side netting. He has the header where he can't quite get enough on it to either flick it over the keeper, pick out his teammate. It's Nunez who plays a through ball to Gakpo, who should have squared it, shoots, I think, over the bar. Like, suddenly Liverpool are creating that little bit more, and you knew things were going to happen if they could put it in the box. I think all three of us pretty much tweeted when they got that corner, last chance here. And there was that feeling that
it's going to be... By the way, they got that corner. You all three tweeted last chance. Then it went 1-0, 1-0. Simicast shot blocked. It just made me laugh at the time. I was thinking, what's going on? What's going on?
Yeah, for those of you that aren't watching, everybody, because it's an audio, 1-0, you pointed at me.
Yeah, sorry. Then Simicast shot block was Theo, which obviously you were like, because Simicast's shot was travelling, wasn't it?
It was good.
Yeah, so sorry, but go on, good.
What was my point there? Nunez.
Yeah.
So you just knew there was going to be that chance that it could have this big dramatic finish. And it's a great leap from him. It's a great header. But let's give McAllister a shout. That's the assist of the season by far. The way he's managed to get his body...
The other one was McAllister to Nunez against West Ham, wasn't it? It's another great assist.
Was that for a penalty? Or did he actually score?
No, he scored. The little dink.
There's so many great passes from McAllister. We could just do a whole podcast on him. I know Beth Lindop's a massive fan. And you just enjoy watching him more and more every week. But with Nunez's celebrations, you hope he didn't have a foot injury the last couple of weeks, because he might have done his toe again or something.
Yeah,
advertising Auden. But he always gives Liverpool a chance. And how many clubs now sing that song about him, about Andy Carroll, only to have to eat their words 10, 15, 20 minutes later? We've seen it a number of times last year, even more this year. Long may it continue.
So they were shouting when he was about to come on, but always he was trying onto the pitch, and so I put the tweet out saying, "We just, you know, what's going to happen now, don't we?"
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting that to happen, like, but he did kind of.
He's going to change the course of the game in some way.
Just listening to Theo, then that's just reminded me of it's if you've got he's a little bit like Jota in the sense that he doesn't care, basically. Yeah. By which I mean, he'll have a shot from anywhere. And in a game like the one against Forest, where Liverpool were getting more of the ball but weren't really getting opportunities, you've got somebody just going to shoot from everywhere. That kind of builds a bit like in the reverse of, you know, when players go through their offside, it looks like they've had a chance, and Klopp absolutely fumes about that because he says, well, it makes them look as though they had three or four chances instead of saying that. But this actually is Liverpool just getting more on top and him having a shot side netted over, blocked. Suddenly you get that feeling of, oh, they're getting chances here. But most of them he's making himself. But obviously with the, as Theo said, with the McAllister thing, it's like time slowed down, wasn't it? Yeah. It's all the best players like that. It's like, oh, I'll just get this ball. And Endo did well, actually, to press up and help force the error that gave Liverpool the possession.
He is the best Liverpool player of all time.
But he took McAllister a little clip, and then he was just asking. Oh, if you watch the replay as well, which actually quite good, is that Nunes kind of runs backwards to make sure he's onside, and as soon as that he's got that ball, his leg, and he's away from Nico Williams. And of course, if you're in a, you know, Nico Williams, I think, is a good player, but he's never going to beat Nunes in a jump, is he? So
it's a tough header as well, because he's sort of running one way, turns, and he's on the turn, watching it, trying to look where the goal is.
Was that Burnley that he scored against recently? Yeah, the header at the far post. Yeah. It was a little bit like that, where he's stretching and doing that. But, you know, he is somebody who, when he comes on, say, like Jota, he's not fussed if he misses, and he'll just carry on, just out shots from wherever.
There's strikers like that, and there's some strikers that seem quite passive, and they wait. I think Gakpo can sometimes be a little bit passive. I quite like Gakpo, he's a very different type of player, but sometimes waiting for the service. And what I like about Nunes is, as soon as he comes on, he involves himself. Yeah, he might have a couple of wild shots, but it's almost like part of the process for him of getting warmed into the game and being involved. I'm not saying he's anywhere near as good, but he reminds me of Suarez in the sense that Suarez couldn't be on the periphery of a game ever. He had to be.
I think it's right centre stage. It's kind of I don't want to go all like regionalistic, but it's a bit of a South American thing, isn't it? Because a lot of their forwards are like that. Tennis was.
And he's very good for it. And the other thing I've been very impressed with is, you saw last season as he came in, obviously didn't speak a lot of the language, was struggling to adapt tactically. You could see him sort of looking a bit lost in games. Whereas now he comes on and you feel like his teammates are like, he's the man, you know, he's going to make something happen. Everyone knows it. They trust him. He trusts them. And more and more, I just feel like, I feel like with Nunes, he will just keep getting better and better. And I think next season could even be better for him because the numbers he's posting are good. But we know from some of the misses he had, certainly in the early part of the season, the numbers could get even better. So yeah,
said that since he first came in. He's like Jota in the first sense of he can score every single goal. And we saw that from the compilations before he joined Liverpool.
Yeah.
We saw that just from Benfica playing against Liverpool. And then when he comes in, you see the misses. And it wasn't a good season for Liverpool last year. For starters, they had to change the style of play a little bit, so the crosses weren't coming in as much.
Yeah.
So he wasn't getting anywhere near as many Trent assists for it as we thought he was going to get. But this goal is one of those things that you saw him score for Benfica. The fact that he is still a big target man, he will win anything in the air if you put it on his head. But he's also got the power, the pace. He might have a raw finish in him, but when he gets it right, he scores. Like, we've seen him have some really calm, composed finishes this season. We've seen him cut inside and put it in the top corner from 25 yards. He is sort of slowly becoming more and more of this complete striker, and he's still so young as well. So yeah, I'm all with you there. He's just going to get better and better. And it's exciting to see what a new manager can do with him as well. Like sometimes having that fresh start gets even more from you, a bit of more hunger to improve, something else to tweak your game. He's going to get 20 this season. It could be 30 next year.
Alexis McAllister, you wrote about him, Doyle, in your analysis. The slight change of position for him. I thought he was playing really well in defensive midfield position. He played it quite differently. You know, he was very good at sort of interceptions and getting the ball on the front foot from deep areas. But now we're starting to see the really, you know, that pass, Theo said, you know, super pass, the way he shifts it onto his left foot and dinks it in. But we're seeing him become more and more influential himself, aren't we?
Well, from Man City away onwards is when he really twigged in terms of how he plays as a defensive midfielder. I think with Endo, I think Liverpool's other players had to get used to the fact that it was McAllister and played a different way. With Endo, he's a little bit more like Fabinho in the way that he plays.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Or a little bit more progressive than Fabinho, but he's more like that. So it's been easier for them to go, oh, there's this player who's more of a normal or orthodox number six. So that's been easy. It took a while to get used to McAllister, but I mean,
I obviously went on tour with them to Germany and Singapore in the summer. And McAllister was playing in that advanced role. And I remember writing stuff like, oh, my God, he's going to be amazing for Liverpool. Mm-hmm. And, of course, then he didn't go backwards, but he was kind of shackled in a way by players. Because if you weren't able to see, there were the hints, like the game against West Ham where he did set up the goal for Nunes. He's like, well, that's what he can do when he's a lot nearer the box. And he wasn't able to do that much until Endo comes in. And, of course, then instantly McAllister gets injured.
Yeah.
Then McAllister comes back and Endo goes away. So at the start of February, so it's only been like a month, 5-6 weeks that he's finally been able to show what he's all about. And you're seeing now that, I mean, Liverpool bought him for £35 million. Just like, it's up there with, it's a bit early days, I know, but it's up there with Mane and Salah in terms of bargain for the balance of play that you get.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at some of the signings around the league and it's, again, a very, very good deal. I also wanted to talk about Quiven Kelleher, and I feel like for him, so we know that Alisson's injury is not going to be a short one for him, Theo. He needs to, I think, keep showing himself and showing people around that Liverpool aren't going to lose out too much with Alisson being out. And again, he made another couple of really crucial saves. I mean, that's 3 clean sheets in a week. That'll do him the world of good. But
first time this season, if I feel.
First time for the season. But he's making crucial interventions in those games, isn't he?
Yeah, earlier in the season in the cup games in Europe, when a striker was 1-on-1, you expected them to score, and 9 times out of 10 they did score, whereas you wouldn't have that feeling when it was Alisson goal. But now we're seeing Kelleher with rhythm, how good he really is. And goalkeepers, they do need rhythm. I know Klopp said before it's a bit different in terms of any of the outfielders that you can put them in, but when they have that run of games, you see how good they are. It wasn't as busy as afternoon compared to some of the games he's had. Like, his best save is probably the one from Alango, which probably would have been called back for offside.
Great save.
It was a great save with his feet. Mm-hmm. He gets down low, doesn't he? Was it for Hudson-Odoi in the second half? He didn't have too much else to do in terms of actual saves, but then Sells can say the same at the other end. But when the keeper is good with his feet, he gets another clean sheet. He knows how to, when to distribute it. A goal, the final 2 minutes comes from him kicking it upfield, picking the right passing. And he's showing he's a leader at the back as well. Like, it's got to the point now where you're almost bordering on, depending on when Alisson's back, do you just stick with Keller until the end of the season? Because he's going to play the Europa League games anyway. If he gets you into an FA Cup final, do you just keep him there for the FA Cup? And then you don't want to rock the boat too much if you're going for a Premier League title. It's a big call to make.
It's a big call. It's not a long way.
It depends entirely when Alisson is back. But the fact that we can have that faith and that confidence in Keller says so much about how he has come on since he's got this one on the team. I think the Fulham game, everyone was writing him off, saying, get ready, he's not very good. It's only 2-3 months on now, and you're back to thinking, best number two in world football. He could easily be the number one if Alisson wasn't there.
There's a lot of Premier League, goalkeepers around the Premier League that I think would kill to have Quiven Kelleher as their number one, because I think he is just that good. And I think you're absolutely right. The rhythm thing, yeah, we saw in the Fulham game, you know, those types of moments, but now that you've seen him with match rhythm, what I think is so interesting about Kelleher is he's just so much like Alisson. And obviously, a lot of Alisson in training is sort of rubbed off on Kelleher, the way that he plays. He gets out quick, he's in people's faces, and he makes those one-on-one saves because he's so good like Alisson at closing the distance.
For this as well.
Yeah, and you know what? We haven't talked about it for a long time, but it wasn't that long ago. Well, it was about 8 years ago. The people used to criticise Hector Berg, having never seen him take a training session in their lives. But I remember having that argument with people. And you look at the way those two goalkeepers play, and they're like carbon copies, aren't they?
You've got to be a good player to score past Hector Berg.
Ian Doyle once scored the goal against Hector Berg in a mess around at Melwood.
It was a mess around.
He'd
never been invited.
Ian Doyle also reckons he'd get 20 a season if he played Liverpool up front. But we won't waste time because we're against
it. A different pod. Go back to Kelleher. What I would say about Kelleher, it's the same as Qualls, the same as Bradley. Now, the same, I think, personally, Bobby Clark is when you see their name on the team sheets, you don't go, oh, you know, worries in any shape or form.
Yeah, spot on. Well, I'll let you expand on Bobby Clark, because that was his first Premier League start, and you are the number one, well, maybe behind Lee, number two in the Bobby Clark fan club. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think he's great. I think, again, I think a lot with Keller as well, with Jota and with Nunes, they don't care in a good way. They were, you know, he's not flustered. You just knew from, you know, there wasn't any second thought when you saw his name. As I said before, there wasn't a second thought when you saw his name on the team sheet.
I mean, for some people who haven't seen him play, possibly they're like, who's this? Mm. But if you've seen him play, I know, I think most people have seen him play from the, you know, the League Cup final, the FA Cup game, and now this one. I think, obviously, the way that the game went meant that he was one of the ones that was always going to be sacrificed early. Yeah. Liverpool needing a little bit more from the bench, and they got it with Endo, Szoboszlai, and Nunes, obviously. But I think he's very, very clever in his positioning. He uses the ball really well. We saw that he created a chance for himself, didn't he, where he took the ball inside and had the shot, which wasn't too far over. But the one thing that impressed me more than anything is that physically, he doesn't look as though there's a lot, but he just proper gets stuck in.
Yeah.
He wasn't fussed about who he was coming up against. He was trying to rob the ball, doing this and the other, putting tackles in, didn't always get it right. But if you're a midfielder, he just seems like somebody, if you go up against, he's going to be all over you. He's a bit of a pest, a little bit like Wijnaldum. I'm not saying he's Wijnaldum, I'm just saying he's got that one particular trait, completely different player to him. But I didn't think if you're going to be a midfielder, certainly, I'm going to say in a Klopp midfield, there's only about 14 games left or whatever it is, but going forward as a, you know, in the modern era, modern game, he can just be whatever he wants to be because he can do all of it. And that's no pressure there, Bobby, just to go on and become the greatest player in the history of the world football.
Right, okay. Well, hopefully he doesn't put that type of pressure on him.
He probably already has. He's been in the interviews, hasn't he, since the cup final.
Before he's already won more trophies than him.
He's got the confidence and swagger, doesn't he? Part of it's because he's Geordie. Part of it's because he's coming in those father's footsteps. That's the horrible wording. Part of it's because he's following in those father's footsteps. But he's so confident on the ball. Like Dordie says, you don't have any faith in him. There was one moment in the first
half. You don't have any faith in him. You need a sip of Carabao.
You don't have any doubt about him.
Yeah.
There was one moment in the first half when I just expected him to get absolutely clattered off the ball and he still somehow manages to run away with it. But when you play with that confidence that a lot of young players do have, but it just seems a bit different with Clark.
Yeah.
And I think there's a little bit like Connor Bradley here, where because of injuries, we've not seen him as much this season as we would have done. And if we had seen him first half of the season in those Europa games, in more of the cup games, then he wouldn't be a little bit taken aback when he just burst onto the scene. But those two and Kwanzaa, incredible season. They are going to be first team players next year. You want to see as much of them as possible. But when they're competing with some world class footballers here, and not looking out of place. Fair play to the three of them.
Yeah, fair play indeed. Before we talk Prague, and I don't just mean Stag Do's, all those excellent cinnamon swizzly things that they sell. Have you ever had one of them in Prague?
To a Stag Do in Prague?
Never, not what? A Stag Do in Prague. But have I eaten one of those excellent cinnamon swizzly things?
Mm.
Have you eaten one of them in Prague?
The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, they're excellent. I don't know what they're called. And he'd love
they're actually called cinnamon swizzly things.
Oh, they? Yeah, literally.
That's literally the Czech translation.
Very good. They're very good. But before we talk Prague, I want to quickly talk title race. Man City won yesterday. I think I texted Doyle after Man United went 1-0 up saying, that's great and all, but they'll get beat 4-1 because they're just so bad. They're so bad, Man United.
That's the best consolation goal since Ben Tekkers.
Yeah, absolutely right. I sometimes think you look at these teams like Man United or even Newcastle at the moment, or Chelsea. Chelsea's a good example, and you see them go to a place like, Chelsea did take points,
so it kind of
ruins my. But Man United yesterday go a goal up. But if Fulham went a goal up against Man City away, I wouldn't be sitting there thinking, "Oh, Fulham are going to turn over Man City." Man United are so bad, it's unreal. We could do a whole 15
I didn't watch the full game, so I've seen Rashford's goal, but the Haaland goal, it's, what on earth are United thinking? Like, it's a hospital pass from Fernandes, isn't it? And then Amrabat.
Oh, to be fair, the 2-1 down to that point.
Yeah. The great thing I thought about that is Liverpool were linked a lot with Amrabat. And he was one of those players, wasn't he? He played well at the World Cup. And I kept thinking to myself, anyone who signs Amrabat has got a big problem with their transfer strategy.
Is that long?
But anyone who sort of falls into the trap. His agent was obviously trying to get him anywhere
work with him before the Netherlands can get you trapped.
But you could see that his agent was desperately trying to get him a move off the back of a half-decent World Cup. And all the sensible clubs said, no, thank you, we don't want him. And Man United touched him. I think that shows you just how...
You do realise that they've got played Manchester United twice soon, so
they are.
We'll score the winner in both games. And we'll blame you.
But they are also a very bad football team, so even if they win both of those games, they're still a very bad football team, and Liverpool are a much better
Why are we talking
team.
About them in the title?
Anyway, I want to talk about the title race because Man City won yesterday. It's just Arsenal incredibly play. Arsenal play tonight. It's Arsenal incredibly. If you were listening to this on Tuesday, Arsenal won 3-0. Chris Wilder 5-0. Chris Wilder had to go with the referee for eating a tortilla wrap whilst blacking himself. It's just incredibly. It feels like we've had this thing with City where anyone who drops a point. If you draw at Nottingham Forest 0-0, it's the absolute worst result in the world. But now with three teams, it's just incredibly intense, isn't it? So it must be hard for the players.
Well, the funny thing is that I actually think that the injury problems, which, as we've spoken quite a few times, I think means Liverpool won't win the league, is actually helping keep the pressure off.
Yeah.
Because there's that kind of... Klopp said it himself, didn't he, after the game? He said, the last four games, I know only two of them were league games, but he said, he just told me 12 days ago we were going to win all the four games, and I said no chance, because he knew the issues that Liverpool were facing in terms of selection. So I think the pressure's slightly off Liverpool, which is, again, seems odd considering they're the team that's top. And who is the pressure on then? I think, you know, City never show signs.
They never show signs
of any pressure. And Arsenal are just playing, you know, pretty well at the moment. I think when City play against Arsenal, it'll be a massive one for Arsenal.
Yeah.
I think depending on what happens then, it depends on whether they fall away, because we've still got 11 games to go. I saw someone saying, is this the best title race ever? And I'm like, it's only just March. We haven't even gone to the interesting bit yet. These are just everyone still jostling position. I remember jostling for position even. I remember in Christmas people saying, oh, five or six teams can win the league. And it's like, no, they can't.
One of them is Tottenham.
Exactly, one of them is Aston Villa. These teams are not going to win it. Yeah. Not yet, anyway.
Yeah. Klopp's been saying his press conferences for a while now. Come back to me in April. Then we'll have the conversation. Yeah. We've been saying this for a while because it is so tight at the top and you're not sure who's going to break away and build that lead. That's when you can say who's really contenders or not. Like, if Liverpool beat Man City at the weekend and get that four-point lead, that's massive for them, and you'd like to think they can hold on. But we've seen City claw it back before.
But that's why I think for Liverpool and Arsenal, the Theo, is that they are in this position where they feel like... Like Man City, if they fell 6 points behind, even going into April, I think Man City would still be like, well...
6 points in is a lot.
It is a lot. But if you're Man City, they probably still would believe that they could win that title. And they probably, more than anyone, you'd back them. If Liverpool and Arsenal 6 points behind going to April, you're saying no chance. And that's why I think for Arsenal and Liverpool, they know how tough it is against City, so they're desperate to keep their noses in front.
We were talking about this on the drive.
And any sort of lead is massive.
And we're saying, if Liverpool-Man City is a draw, Arsenal go top of the league, don't they, on goal difference?
Yeah.
Arsenal aren't winning the league, in my opinion, from there, because Man City will beat them. I still reckon it will be a two-horse race, Liverpool versus Man City.
I've said all season, kind of written Arsenal off at times, but I think they've done very well to keep themselves in it. And after they rocked around Christmas... Sounded like they had a great time. Rocking around the Christmas tree. But after they had that rocky period around Christmas, and then they beat Liverpool, and we take the mick out of them a little bit for some of the response after that. I think it, in hindsight, was very important because it's brought them back, and I think they're in a very good position now, Arsenal. So I think it is shaping up to be, I won't say the most exciting title race of all time, but there's only one for the past few years because it's gone from two horses to three, hasn't it? So
I still think City will have bought it before the end of this, before the last game of the season.
Yeah, but even if they have done that, I don't think we're talking maybe two games, three games, not.
Well, how often is that? How often is the title decided? More, you know, this normally two or three games, because two games is 6 points. Mathematically, it's still quite a lot. So it's just as Liverpool have lost it twice by a point on the last day.
Yeah. Mm. Let's talk Prague then. Let's pick our teams because there isn't a great deal to say.
One of us already knows about Sparta Prague.
What do you know about Sparta Prague? What is your favourite Sparta Prague player?
What do I know about Sparta Prague?
Nothing.
I
was just putting you on the spot.
I know they're top of the table, and I'm pretty sure they've only lost one game in the league this season.
Name your top three Sparta Prague players in the current team. Right, that's
the goalkeeper.
Yeah, the goalkeeper.
He's a very important player.
Yeah,
the striker. He's the one who gets the goals.
Yeah,
and the midfielder tends to be the one who ties things together.
Yeah,
so keep your eye on those three.
Yeah, and the defenders work very hard.
Fullbacks and wingers offer good width.
Yeah. We'll have to check that.
The substitutes always make a difference to the game result.
Yeah. You missed. I said we have to check that. So anyway, let's pick our teams. I have two because you took right. Keller in goal, not Adrian. Any Adrians?
I think Adrian's game was Southampton, and if he's not playing in that, he's not playing in any of them unless Keller gets injured.
Okay, so there's no point in me asking you a goalkeeper. So it's Keller in your back four.
I would play Quansah and Van Dijk at centre back to start and take Van Dijk off at half time and put Canate on. Left back is going to be Kostas Tsimikas, and right back Conor Bradley.
I agree with three of the four. I'm going Joe Gomez at right back. Bradley, still a young player, he's obviously not going to be playing at amazing heights week after week in the circumstances and everything. Take him out the firing line for this one.
I wouldn't start Van Dijk just because I think that, that game at the weekend is like a cup final, and I think he's played a lot of football recently. Van Dijk, I would probably take him out.
Put Canate in the place three times in a week.
That is true.
Because then it's got to be more intense the second half of the game.
Well, the other option is to play Gomez at centre back, isn't it?
And, so I'm playing Gomez. Hits Man City, so that's why he needs a rest.
Okay, so we've somehow got a back four then. We're working out at home. Write it down. Midfield.
Go on.
I was going to let Theo start.
Endo can be the sitter.
Yeah.
Bobby Clark can keep his place, and then McAllister can complete the trio. Because Szoboszlai had that hamstring injury, we've already seen him suffer a setback. He can be a substitute again.
Certainly don't rush Szoboszlai.
Endo, Clark, and Szoboszlai. He can have the first 45 minutes. Bring somebody on at halftime.
Yeah, I would stay with Theo just because I am a little bit worried that he's easing back in Szoboszlai. I wouldn't want to put too much pressure on him early doors. No shouts for any McConnells in with that midfield.
Not this time.
Just try and keep it tight in the first.
Never goes 30 minutes off the bench.
Yeah. Okay, your forward line.
Dan's Coombs and Gordon.
Yeah?
No.
To be fair, you joke.
But the fact is, that's what I've got to say.
Yeah.
Well, I think you've got to play. Nunes has to play. So he'll play down the middle.
Yeah.
Diaz had his rest the other day, so I think he can play as well, certainly to start. Mm. And right... come back to me on that one.
I think he's
playing like...
He needs a rest. Father's played so much football.
Yeah. But then do you play Elliot in the knowledge that Salah's coming back and Elliot won't play against Man City?
That would be my thinking.
Yeah. Yes, you've sold me into it there.
Mm.
Potentially. It could be another one where you just do 45 minutes for a Cody Gakpo, 45 minutes for a Harvey Elliot.
Yeah.
I agree with the other two that Doyle said there, Nunes and Diaz.
Even with Nunes, I'd be tempted, depending on what type of position Liverpool in, I'd be tempted to take him off to 45 and throw Jadon Dans on and say go and have a half and give Nunes... Keep Nunes in cotton wool, because I kind of think it's the sort of game that if Liverpool draw in Prague, perfect, take it back to Anfield.
He's not in the squad yet, Jadon Dans. We'll find that out tomorrow, I think.
Yeah, does he have to be? You're the squad master.
Basically,
you're
the home run king.
If I'm looking for a job with Carabao, you're looking for an admin job at Liverpool to sort out the squad.
Yeah, it's a Tuesday or Wednesday they'll update this because they updated the actual one with Adrian replacing Matip.
Right, well, give us a prediction, Theo.
Without... I'm just going off what Doherty said here about Sparta Prague. It sounds like a really formidable out.
That
midfield is the one you've got to keep your eye on.
2-0
Liverpool.
2-0 Liverpool.
I've been to Sparta. The Chimmoop Grounds, I think. Don't know.
Gosh, you know a lot about Sparta Prague.
I've been to their stadium.
Is it the new ground or is it an old one? Well, I went to the game in 2010 with a 0-0. It was incredibly cold. I can remember that. So
it's incredibly dull as well.
With that, 0-0s tend to be, to be fair. With that in mind, I think it'll finish 1-1.
Yeah.
I think it's a massive game for them. And I think if you actually look at the Czechia teams, because we don't call it the Czech Republic anymore, their teams are doing reasonably well in Europe this year, and certainly in the lower competitions, such as the Europa League, unfortunately, and the Conference League. So, big game for them. I think as long as Liverpool don't lose by more than 2 goals, they should get through.
Yeah, I think it's dead easy to dismiss these types of teams as like fodder almost. But like you said, and you don't often go to, and someone will probably pull out some stat that makes me look like an idiot, but I don't feel like you go to these Eastern European places and just go and roll someone over 3-0. It's often a really hard fought game.
Eastern Europe?
Yeah. Of course it is.
Or Central?
I thought it was Central.
I'd say Central. Yeah. I would thought Czech is the start of the East.
But where's the centre then?
Germany.
Where does the centre of Europe start?
It's a loading poorly question. Tell us if you're listening at home, write to the Echo. And just literally say, I would have said I'd always thought of it as Eastern Europe, but maybe I'm wrong there. I'm sorry if I am. But check back in on Friday for the result of that game and some build up to Man City.
Because bring like map minutes for that one so we can clarify this argument on the next podcast.
We're back on video as well. We should just open.
I'm not. I'm not ready to argue over it. I stand corrected. If it's Central Europe, then that's fine. I did go there once. It was very, very cold.
Where?
To Prague.
Oh, yeah,
very, very cold.
Did you go?
December.
What did you expect then?
I didn't say
February, I think it was, or March. And I've also been in August. It was really hot there. June, July time. It was hot.
So check back in Friday and we'll be here to talk Prague. We'll be here to talk Man City and look ahead to a massive, massive game in Liverpool's season. Thanks for listening. See you then. Ta-ra.
You've been listening to the Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.